Finance Policy Meeting for February 18th to order. First of all, we have to go through some formalities. Basically, it says you need to behave yourself. But welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives. We appreciate your interest and participation in our process. Now, to make sure everybody is heard and included, we have some ground rules. So here they are. The committee chair, that's me, gets to maintain control of the proceedings. If you don't behave, then that's why we have yellow type folks. I don't think we'll ever have a problem here. Signs and place cards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, and disruptive behaviors will not be tolerated even from members. Applause or other type of demonstrations are not allowed. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in walkways or aisles or anything that obstruct the view of the front of the table is prohibited. We'll get it out. Troopers and health security personnel are present to ensure everybody's safety. And if you received a ticket, it's not to a movie, okay? It allows you to get back in if you leave, okay? And so forth. So please don't lose them. And then failure to comply to these guidelines means that you go into timeout, okay? And Representative Doe is the person that handles that, right?
Yes, sir.
There you go. Okay, so thank you. I know this is serious, especially with what happened. I'm adding a little humor to it, but we are here to do the people's business, and we need that atmosphere to do that business. So with that said, Representative Nadeau, would you like to move on the May 7th minutes?
So moved.
Okay. Any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes of May 7th, 2025 are approved. Okay, first of all, we are going to begin with a presentation from the Minnesota Department of Health on the Rural Health Transformation Program application. And so I invite the Minnesota Department out. Oh, before I do that, I'm sorry. Two things before I do that while you're moving. We have a new Joe. We have Miss Melissa Stein. If you could say something about yourself, I appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Melissa Stern. I am the new fiscal analyst for this committee, and I'm excited to be back in action. From 2012 to 2016, I was the education fiscal analyst for the House, and so I have that background for a few years. Then I went, after leaving the House in 2016, I went to DHS and worked in their budget analysis division doing legislative work, and most recently I've been at the Minnesota Department of Health in their financial management area. So I'm happy to be back and dusting off my old skills and bringing my perspective of some of the agency work to the committee work that we do, and I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And then last year, all members introduced themselves, and seeing that we have a new member, if Representative Lee, if you would want to, replacing our House member that went to the Senate, but if you could give a little bit of yourself, we appreciate that, Representative Lee.
Yeah, absolutely. Hello, everybody. It's my pleasure and my honor to be here as part of this Health Committee. XP Lee, 34B, and, you know, Speaker Emerita Hortman, you know, led with a lot of commitment to public service, a lot of passion for progressive issues, and I'm obviously going to try to follow in her footsteps, inspired by all of the words shared yesterday, and looking forward to, again, working towards making health and health care for all Minnesotans a priority and something that will work to keep Minnesotans' mindfulness and well-being secure into the future. So, really happy to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Lee. We welcome you to our committee and so forth. Thank you. Back to MDH. We have Diane Rydrick, Is that cool? Wow, we get a point in horseshoes, folks. Thank you. The Health Policy Division Director and Zoa Ratrick?
Zora Radasevich.
Okay, I believe you. I believe you. Thank you. From the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care to come to the table, and they're already there. So both of you together, and Mr. Ager will be timing, but we want to try to keep this down to about 22 minutes. So with that, whoever wants to go first, go for it, and then we'll take questions afterwards. Thank you. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Oh, and also just reminder to everybody in here, if there is questions, we direct it through the chair. It just allows people to know how things are going. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, excuse me, I'm Diane Rydrick. I'm the Director of the Health Policy Division at MDH. People rarely get my last name right, so good start.
Thank you.
And I've been told I have a soft voice, so I'm going to do my best to lean in on the mic here as much as I can. So before we get started, just a note. We've got some slides at the front of the presentation here that we're not going to go through today, but you have them. Just in the interest of time, we wanted to make sure you had these initial 8 or 9 slides that come from what we call the Rural Health Chart Book, which is something we update every year or two at MDH just to provide kind of the landscape of rural health. What do we know about access to care, travel time, workforce needs, closures of services, et cetera? So I'm going to kind of fly through those right now, but we're not going to talk about them. They're important, though, to understand because they sort of lay the groundwork for the Rural Health Transformation Program, and they give you a good sense of what access to care looks like in rural areas and what some of the challenges are. But we're going to focus our presentation on the grant itself. And just a quick note, we're talking here about what we submitted to CMS back in November. As with any grant, it's sort of a living thing, and it's an ongoing relationship with the federal funder. So it is possible that they will ask us to make changes at some point down the line, and things could change. So we're speaking to what we submitted, but just know over the course of 5 years, it's possible it could look a little bit different if CMS asks us to change anything about it. So just a little bit of background. For those who are less familiar, the Rural Health Transformation Program grew out of H.R. 1, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which passed on July 4th of 2025. It is a one-time $50 billion five-year pot of funding that is intended to go to and is going to all 50 states for rural health transformation. That's $10 billion a year across 5 federal fiscal years. The application guidance came out from CMS in the middle of September, and the applications were due on November 4th. So if you have been involved in federal grants before, that is a really, really, really short time to pull together a complex application. So we're proud of what we pulled together, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the public input that went into that. Each state was asked to apply for $200 million per year, or $1 billion across 5 years, so we did. And it's one application for all 5 years of funding. But that doesn't mean that we are not in relationship with and reporting back to CMS throughout those 5 years. So the amount of funding could change in the out years as our results come into CMS and if priorities change on the CMS side. We got news of our award on December 29th, and we are receiving just over $193 million for the first fiscal year. We hope that that will be the amount that we get each year, but that's what we have for the first year right now. And future years will be dependent on results, and again, dependent on any changes in priorities or direction. All 50 states received funding. They averaged out to $200 million a year. I think the lowest was around $147, and the highest was closer to $300 million. We spent a lot of time in that 5 or 6 weeks while we were developing the application, getting public input into it. We had a public comment that we opened up for a couple of weeks in September. We got more than 350 comments. We included the map because I think it's helpful to see that we got comments from all corners of the state, almost every county. I'd have to do the math for myself, but I think that looks like 79 or 80 counties that we had at least somebody, an individual or an organization, that gave feedback to us. And we asked them what they think the most important priorities are for improving rural health in their communities, and we asked them what the challenges are and what they see as the opportunities that we should focus on. In addition to that, we had more than 50 meetings with a range of external partners, some of whom are in the room today, but many of whom are people you all work with on a regular basis. We met with legislative leads and chat and talked a few times with our congressional delegation. We collaborated very closely with the Minnesota Hospital Association, the Association of Community Health Centers, and the Association of Community Mental Health Programs, all of whom wrote letters of support for our application, along with the other entities noted below. We were really pleased to get letters of support for the application from both both of the caucuses in both the House and Senate, DFL and GOP, and from all of the Republican members of the congressional delegation, as well as both of our senators. So everybody cares about rural health. Everybody has, you know, outside of the metro, everyone has a hospital or a rural health provider in their district, and there's a lot of concern about access and a lot of support for taking what steps we can to address challenges. So I'm going to go through just two more slides, and then I'm going to hand it over to my colleague. CMS laid out five areas of priority, or five domains for states to focus on. And for us, happily, the feedback that we got from the public comment really closely aligned with what CMS laid out as priorities. So we identified five goals for our grant, and you will see that the activities all align with these goals. I'm not going to read all the words on this page, but generally the five goals relate to improving outcomes for people who have certain serious chronic conditions like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and chronic kidney disease, improving the healthcare workforce, expanding the healthcare workforce pipeline, and improving retention, expanding access through community-based care in rural areas, strengthening partners between providers to deliver services in rural areas, and then strengthening financial health of rural providers. And last slide for me, the strategic initiatives that you'll hear about in just a second from my colleague align with those five goals. So you will see that we are going to be funding activities in rural communities and from rural providers in these five areas that align with the goals. So my colleague, Ms. Radosevich, is going to highlight some of those activities that would be funded under the initiatives, and then we'll talk about implementation of the grant.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Zora Radosevich, Director of the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care in the Minnesota Department of Health. We'll start with our first initiative, community-based preventative care and chronic disease management. Those were two of the clear priorities of external partners as we were going through the engagement phase, as we were preparing for that grant. And some of the key activities within those initiatives were to improve and increase chronic disease screening, education, referral, and follow-up, and to promote and expand on chronic disease self-management in clinics and in communities. So really trying to look at, take a really comprehensive approach to addressing the risk factors of these diseases and to help ensure that rural Minnesotans are able to access community-based care. Our second initiative, workforce, was a crucial priority, and it's something that we do a lot of work on in our office now. We recognize it's important to start young to introduce students to healthcare, and so one of the first activities under our initiative to recruit and retain talent in rural communities is to introduce more high school students to healthcare careers. We're also expanding on the apprenticeship programs that exist in the healthcare area to try to do more earn and train and to help people grow their own within these rural communities of people who start out in a healthcare career and then can advance through in that career. We're expanding on rural clinical rotations and rural residencies for physicians and advanced practice providers. Those are two programs that we do some work on now with the state. The legislature has funded in the past, and we will be expanding on those opportunities, building on the research that shows that people do tend to practice when they train, and so we want to have as much training happen to expose students to rural practices and for those who grew up rural to be able to do that training in rural communities. So as many of you know, rural communities want to maintain access to the many health services that that they have in their own community. And so our third initiative was to sustain access to services that keep care closer to home. And some of these activities within this initiative are to implement or to expand models that integrate frontline care and expand the where people can find access to for both telehealth and also for some of the clinical services that they may need within their community. And we're also supporting more community mental health initiatives, like to do more training on mental health first aid and mental health postvention activities, and to expand telehealth access points like into pharmacies or public health institutions or some schools. Our fourth initiative, to create regional care models that would improve whole person health, is really focused on trying to address that whole person. And so this initiative has a number of activities that are really focusing on long-term sustainability of these services, as well as making sure that access is available. So some of those that I'll highlight we're particularly excited about is we're able to use these Rural Health Transformation Fund program funds to pilot a system that will compensate ambulance services for those 911 responses that result in patient contact but don't necessarily result in or need to return someone to or bring someone to an emergency department. And our hope there is that we will learn a lot about what it takes to maintain those services, and over the course of the 5 years be able to provide information to the legislature and others about what is working in those services. In a similar vein, we're looking at providing bridge grants to some eligible hospitals and birthing centers to try different things that could work to sustain OB service lines in rural communities that meet the population needs of that community. And so we're also looking at building more urgent care centers for mental health, knowing that that's something that has been effective and there just aren't enough of them in the state, and building on the creating children's mental health initiatives that is patterned after the adult mental health initiative that Brooksfield is being effective in providing treatment. And then, because as the research that is included in the chart book that we mentioned earlier shows, that primary care physicians in rural communities are often the front line to specialty care as well. And so some of the funds will be used to develop Project Echoes, which help in primary care physicians learn from their peers and from specialists in other parts of the state and what, you know, how best to improve their own skills and be able to recognize the care that's needed. So we'll be doing that in the mental health and obstetrics field. And then we are working with Community Memorial Hospital in Cloquet to provide OB simulation training to physicians and emergency department personnel in rural spaces where the birth numbers are lower, but they still have services available, or they know that births will happen in an emergency department. And so we're able to use these funds to expand on that effort. And one of the things we heard strongly from rural providers across the state are the challenges that they face financially and in preparing for the changes that are coming in healthcare finance. And so Initiative 5 invests heavily in technology and infrastructure to build that financial stability, to be able to acquire the data management software, to boost capacity for internal management, create efficiencies, help with skill building for healthcare providers, leveraging a range of applications that will improve efficiency of clinical operations and will increase the capacity of current staff to be able to work at the top of their license. Some of the other activities within this initiative are to invest in cybersecurity, which is a necessary tool to protect the data that's being used, and to invest in revenue cycle management tools. So next we'll talk briefly about the planning that's been undertaken to implement the award that we have received.
Just to let you know, you've got about 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. With our total award, we wanted to make it clear that these funds are currently restricted. As Diane mentioned, all of the states were required to submit an application for $200 million. And because our award was $193 million, we had to submit a new budget. That's been submitted to CMS. They're currently reviewing it and asking questions, and until that budget is approved, we can't move forward with the various activities that will be funded by the grant. There are restrictions on how the funds can be spent. They're not meant, and it's been very clearly stated throughout the process, to offset Medicaid losses or to build on expenses that are already reimbursable. So there were definitely restrictions on how the funds could be spent. But we are preparing to move quickly as soon as these funds are released to implement grant programs and make funds available. So as we mentioned, there are substantial requirements that we must meet. We'll need to show progress on implementing the initiatives, and we will be adhering really closely to our implementation plan and timeline once these funds have been released. CMS every year will be requiring, and as well as annual reporting, quarterly reporting, to show progress on how we're implementing these initiatives, how we're adhering to those timelines, and any progress on metrics and evaluation that we will be making a part of every grant that we administer. Metrics are a very heavy portion of what CMS is requiring of all the states. We will be demonstrating progress on our proposed initiatives, as I mentioned, in quarterly and annual progress reports. There are some examples of the kinds of questions we'll be asking, and we're working with our stakeholders to, as much as possible, build on metrics that they already collect, but there are things that we will be required to report, so we'll be working with them on making sure that that's we're able to collect that. Funds will be disseminated on an annual basis. We will receive in October what our award is for the next year. For the first year, because we knew it would be a shortened initial year, the budget periods are based on the federal fiscal year, which starts in October, because the funds won't be released until probably the end of February or March. We wanted to focus on really efficient dissemination. So we had identified partners that will be receiving allotted funds, and we'll be moving forward with those requests or notices of funding opportunities. We've been working closely with them to let them know about the activities so they can be thinking about it ahead of time. And once we're able to post the notice of funding opportunity, we will be receiving their applications with their budgets and timelines, which will need to also be submitted to CMS before we can move forward.
And if there's some we can skip.
So yeah, this slide just shows what the allocation is for the first year of funding. The idea is that for the first year of the year, the majority of the funds are going out in allotments to identified partners, with some funds available for competitive grants that will be administered to fund some of the activities. And then in future years, that percentage will shift. So the allotted funds share will go down and the competitive grant funds will go up. And this was strategic in that we wanted to make sure that people had the opportunity to put partnerships together, collaborate, and to be able to work, you know, on behalf of their whole community in applying for these funds.
I wonder about Josh. I jumped in.
So, yeah, these maps show the 94 hospitals that are eligible for funds in that first year and ongoing. And on the other side are the certified community behavioral health clinics and FQHCs that are available for allocation funds. Okay. We will be, as I mentioned, there are some of these activities do require were identified, a sole source for providing them was identified. Those are some examples. The University of Minnesota, who is providing the physician support for the OB simulation. And there are a handful of sole source grants that will be issued, and then the rest will be competitive.
Got about two minutes.
Okay, compliance and program integrity are key. We are partnering with our internal audit, financial management, our general counsel, and others to make sure that we've instituted the best possible practices. We're incorporating all of the compliance elements that were listed in the NOFO and the RFP, frequently asked questions from CMS. We'll be providing ongoing technical assistance for grantees to make sure that they are able to comply with all of the requirements. And And before, when they submit invoices, progress reports will be submitted and verified. And we are doing extensive training with our grant staff as well to use, to follow all of the procedures that are in place to ensure compliance and program integrity. And we'll be doing in-person monitoring visits throughout the program. I think we've talked about our partner engagement, and we'll leave you with a slide that is shows more where more information can be reached. We will be using the listserv and this website for posting all of our notices of funding opportunity. We'll be updating frequently asked questions and just sharing information through here. And so this is a good source. You can sign up for email notices when they're available, and we will also be holding webinars and meetings with various providers and stakeholders once the funding has been released. And we look forward to continuing to share regular updates with you and are available to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I did have an error. First, we're going to do testifiers, and then we're going to open up to questions. So we have right now on schedule is three testifiers, 3 minutes each. The first one will be Ms. Benson with the Hospital Association. On deck will be Dr. Kemp, and followed by Ms. Jones. So go ahead. State your name, and we'll rock and roll.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Michelle Benson with the Minnesota Hospital Association. Chair Backer, Chair Bierman, and committee members. I represent the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing 139 hospitals and health systems across communities of all sizes across the state. We appreciate the opportunity to comment on Federal Rural Health Transformation Program. Let me begin by asking you, as you consider policy here at the state level, please keep in mind that Minnesota hospitals employ more than 151,000 employees. We support the delivery of 62,000 babies. We partner with EMS, nursing homes, and communities. We also provide over $1 billion in uncompensated care. In 2024, charity care increased by 40%. And according to your own Office of the Legislative Auditor, hospitals provide community benefit far exceeding the value of their tax-exempt status. This is a reminder that hospitals and health systems remain fully committed to caring for every patient, regardless of ability to pay or circumstance. Hospitals are facing historic headwinds. Long-standing challenges include government Medicare and Medicaid system below the cost of care, disruption in financial supports like 340B, and recent and ongoing federal changes under HR 1 are compounding these problems. The directed payment program passed last year with bipartisan support was supposed to mitigate $2 billion in medical assistance underfunding. It is now uncertain and may not provide the relief expected. More frequent Medicaid redeterminations, including new work reporting requirements and administrative barriers, could result in significant coverage losses, adding additional shifting to cover the costs in hospitals. Rising premiums and deductibles in private market coverage may increase the number of uninsured and underinsured Minnesotans, which will increase uncompensated care. These issues hit all hospitals, but rural hospitals face them uniquely and disproportionately. Included in HR 1 was the Rural Health Transformation Program. Minnesota has been awarded $193 million for the first year. First, I would like to say we are cautiously optimistic that this program could provide funding to help modernize and transform some operations at our rural hospitals. It is jointly administered by CMS and the Minnesota Department of Health. The program focuses on chronic care management, workforce development, partnerships and technology-enabled improvements like telehealth. It cannot be used for uncompensated care or service shortfalls. MDH has emphasized that in the first year, the majority will go to hospitals because we are community safety nets, and for that, we are grateful. However, some implementation concerns remain. CMS has required a resubmission of plans to match awards. Detailed provider approvals could delay rollouts. MDH's grant model requires hospitals to incur costs upfront before reimbursement, which complicates project management and cash flow. Our members have expressed concerns. When will the funds be available? And if we have to complete the project by October 1st, what kind of project can we actually roll out? Innovative, complex projects can take several years. Will hospitals be prioritized for funding in years 2 through 5? Should hospitals prioritize RHTP investments if funding is uncertain? MDH and MHA have worked together as Minnesota requested RHP funds from CMS. We look forward to continued collaboration to optimize the impact of these scarce dollars. We appreciate your attention to these critical issues. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We'll provide additional data and discuss solutions as we go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Kemp, you're up next, and then Ms. Jones following. And again, 3 minutes, please. State your name and thank you.
Yes, Chair Backer, Chair Bierman, and committee members. My name is Dania Camp. I am a family physician at Gateway Clinic in Moose Lake, Minnesota, where I have worked for 22 years. I am passionate about rural health care, so passionate that I drove down from Two Harbors today to be with you after working an ER shift last night up there in the blizzard. I am here today, though, as president-elect of the Minnesota Medical Association. So I'm representing the 10,000 physician members that represent every corner of our state. As a rural physician, this $193 million awarded to Minnesota under the Rural Health Transformation Program comes at a very critical time for my patients and for those in greater Minnesota. Physician shortages in Minnesota are persistent, and data shows that they're only going to get worse. Our rural communities have roughly one primary care provider for every 2,700 residents. In comparison, those in the metro, there is one primary care provider for every 965 residents, so nearly three times as many physicians in metro areas. Rural physicians, like myself, are older on average, and unfortunately, nearly one in four rural physicians plans to leave practice in the next 5 years. The shortages do vary by specialty, with access to obstetricians and other specialists decreasing significantly as rural hospitals and clinics are cutting service lines or services, and some being forced to close altogether. For these reasons, I'm hopeful that Minnesota will allocate these funds to tackle physician shortages in rural areas. Activities that work to promote workforce development, expand rural clinical rotations, increase capacity for our rural residency programs, and pilot initiatives like the Family Medicine Obstetrics Fellowship. These incentivize physicians to go into rural areas. I would be remiss not to note how federal policy is affecting healthcare in rural Minnesota. First, Minnesota DHS estimates that federal House Resolution Number 1, the one big beautiful bill, will reduce federal Medicaid support to Minnesota by approximately $1.4 billion annually. Mm-hmm. These cuts will force Minnesota to make difficult decisions about reductions in medical assistance eligibility, coverage, and provider payments. And let's be clear, MA is a rural issue. Approximately 45% of medical assistant enrollees live outside the seven county metro area. That's 550,000 rural Minnesotans who depend on MA for their care. The nonpartisan congressional budget estimates that up to 140,000 Minnesotans will lose their MA coverage in the next 10 years. I want to be as clear as possible that federal cuts to Medicaid will render thousands of rural Minnesotans uninsured. So increased availability of rural physicians matter less when patients are uninsured and can't afford care. The second other federal HR1 change that affects workforce shortages includes changes to federal student loans. This will directly affect our ability to recruit rural physicians. Beginning July 1 of this year, medical students face a $50,000 annual cap on student loans and a $200,000 lifetime cap on federal borrowing. Almost every physician in training relies on these loans to fund their education. And most physicians borrow well over the $200,000 cap. I looked this up, and the average is $246,000 of student loan debt leaving medical school in 2024. And 23% of physicians entering practice have over $300,000 in student loan debt.
If you can wrap it up, please. Thank you.
So as a result, med students will need to turn to alternative lending resources, and I think we will also see fewer people going into medicine unless they come from a wealthy background. So if I leave the committee with anything, let it be this. HR 1 may help us expand our rural workforce through our RHTP program, but it simultaneously limits our workforce and loan reforms and medical assistance cuts. I urge you as a committee to review this grant as one piece of a larger puzzle. Sustained support for Medicaid, continued investment in rural training pathways, residency programs, and policies that make medical education accessible for all students will help ensure access to rural health care for all Minnesotans. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. Thank you, committee members, for your service. And I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay, thank you. While Ms. Jones is coming up to the front there, there are written testimonies in your packet too, members. I know Greater Coalition of Minnesota Cities and some other ones are in there that you may want to take a look. So, Ms. Jones, you have 3 minutes. State your name and go ahead, please.
So short. Thank you to everyone here. My name is Martha Jones Sitchko, and I'm honored to represent Albert Lea, Minnesota, and Freeborn County. I'm a volunteer rural healthcare advocate. I'm not a lobbyist. Albert Lea has become ground zero for a healthcare crisis where patients wait in fear of delayed ambulance, service gaps threaten lives, and residents in Freeborn County pay 30% more for care if they can even get an appointment. This is where Mayo Clinic transfers seniors hours away to a critical access hospital like Cannon Falls so they can collect higher Medicare reimbursements. Let me share an account of what my friend Mimi Lindy endured because it reflects what too many experience. In the ER, imaging revealed a brain cancer. Mimi waited more than 15 hours in the ER before getting transferred to Austin because Mayo gutted Albert Lea's fiscally sound hospital in 2017 and then dismantled all the outpatient. Her patient portal was riddled with convoluted instructions, including the same hour appointments in Austin and Mankato, the long-term care facility Mr. Payne, leading to another 12-hour ER wait for a bed in Mankato, and later a C. diff infection and more problems. The strain overwhelmed her kind heart. She died of cardiac arrest, not cancer. Her funeral was last Saturday. You cannot tell me that our rural health care system didn't hasten her death. Freeborn County was the canary in the coal mine for rural healthcare collapse. Yet for 8 years, the governor, MDH, and maybe legislatures looked away, despite repeated requests to MDH. There have been no patient meetings. I don't know where our patients were in the stakeholders. There's no partnership programs, no interagency task forces, no proposed changes to critical access hospital criteria, no coordinated responses to help with our ambulance strain. You didn't talk to us. I emailed you. Legislators should ask, what has MDH done with taxpayer dollars over the past 8 years? Has their rural health department helped? No, we've asked nothing. MDH acknowledged that county public health budgets, largely state funded, operated with limited oversight to improve health. In Freeborn County, taxpayers paid for a treadmill at a private bank and funded a $200,000 awareness campaign consisting of a few Facebook posts and a school visit. Believe me, I can give you more waste. The funding misalignment has life and death consequences. What criteria did MDH apply to the mandated plans that are due every 5 years? I've asked for performance, nothing. A tick box that says met is not a measurement of performance. A plan buried on a website isn't access. It's nothing. Please acknowledge the system failure and commit to collaborating on access, not managing decline. Compounding the problem is the provider service area law that strips local government from control. What is very concerning is the distribution of the $193 million rural health care transformation. MDEH has already indicated that it will send funds to the $18 billion system that already caused the decimation. This grant, where was all the talk about clinics? That's what we need to sustain. Telehealth is not a panacea. Ask your parents or your pregnant women. We need in-person care. I hope years of nothing have shattered our confidence in MDH. We are calling on you to help us. Rural Minnesotans deserve timely, sustainable care. Please help us.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to do questions. I have a few questions here. First of all, my first question deals with, this would be MDH. Ms. Benson kind of alluded to this a little bit too, but can you clarify this first year funds, how that will be needed to be spent by hospitals? Will those funds be done in full 2026? Or do they have a year after they get the funds? What's the parameters on that, please?
Mr. Chair, the funds that are awarded for this first year, will be available through October or through September of 2027. So they will have a full fiscal year beyond this first fiscal year. And then for every year after that, they would be two full fiscal years. So the awards that happen in October of 26 would have through September of 28.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Jones brought up about the telehealth. I don't know which of you two. Explain to us your thoughts on how telehealth clinics, how that you're looking that they would operate, where would they operate? Could you give a dig down to that a little bit more, please?
So, Mr. Chair, some of those decisions would be made by the entities that would be applying for funds. Okay. That is an allowable activity under the Rural Health Transformation Program. They would decide if this is something that fits the work that they're doing. It's from some of the goals of it were to make sure that rural hospitals and clinics had telehealth backup support for those patients who they are unable to transfer or are able to care for in their community, as long as they have that connection. So there are a variety of uses for telehealth. The other was for those more chronic conditions where someone doesn't need to go be seen in person, that they would have a telehealth access point that was closer to their home so that they wouldn't have to travel when they don't need to. But those would all be patient and provider decisions to use the funds for that purpose.
Okay. Then my next question is in... could be a difficult one, and I appreciate the information, but it appears that the hospitals, which is good news, would receive about 70% of the initial funding and so forth. So when more funding is provided to the providers, it seems like you need less administration. But in your slides and your information, you're looking to spend $9.3 million, which is about 5%, on administration. Can you give us a breakdown of how that allocation was decided?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take that one. So one point of clarification, in the first year, 70% of the funding is going directly to hospitals through an allocation. We will look at our total amount, calculate 70%, divide that by the number of eligible hospitals, which is 94, and they will get that. There are also going to be competitive funding opportunities for additional funding, and hospitals will be eligible for that as well. So I would think of the 70% in the first year as a floor for hospitals rather than a ceiling, because they can apply for competitive grants along the way. In terms of the administrative costs, CMS set a cap of 10% on administrative costs, and they told us at the time of application that would apply to both our costs for administering the grant, like FTEs for grant monitoring and site visits and invoice review, and also the administrative costs at grantees. so what a hospital needs to administer a grant. We're hopeful that they're going to loosen up a little bit on how the recipients, like hospitals and clinics, can use those funds so they have a little more flexibility and can have the staff they need to do the work. We anticipate that our administrative costs are not likely to go down in future years because even with a direct allocation, we're going to have hundreds of grant agreements and contracts that we are administering each year. And it's going to be just as important that we monitor those and do the site visits and evaluate all the expenses in year five as it is in year one. So unless that number of grants and contracts goes down, the administrative costs and the staff needed to really make sure that we are managing the expense of those funds effectively and appropriately will stay where it is in year one.
Okay, thank you. And we have several other members' questions. I will save my others to the end. Just a comment, it seems like there's a lot of new staff that's being added to this, and that's concerning to me, where we've heard from the hospital association, because I understand there's 26 new staff members that's being added, and my last question would be is, where did we get data? How was that determined that 26 is needed at that type of cost?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you for that question, and we can follow up with additional detail on the types of FTEs that are in the budget, and I think that'll be helpful. The majority of them are people who are doing that really important grant management work and making sure that funds are spent as they should be based on allowable activities and that invoices and expenses are validated as they should be. But there are also some staff in our financial management area to assist us with that program integrity work and some content expertise in other parts of the department to help the recipients, whether those be hospitals or tribes or providers, do this work well. We can follow up with the detail.
Yes, I would like that detail. Members, we have five members with questions. My goal is to land the airplane about three after two. With that, Representative Hewitt, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate I'm going to have a couple of questions here real quick, but I'll go quick, and I want to go back to a statement that I really appreciate her coming in, Martha Jones. However, I do want to point out that this has been a goal of ours to make sure we're helping rural EMS. Both the chair and I have worked on this personally, and we're starting to get reports back. But as far as the Mayo Ambulance Service, they received over $1 million to work on innovation by the committee before this in the House, and it was a bipartisan approach. We actually gave out $30 million to help ambulance services around the state, and we're now getting those reports. But I would say that Mayo did get their fair share to try to work out the problems. But to get to the question here, and I have one for Ms. Benson, too, if she could come up. But I noticed in the ambulance area that you're looking at not required to transport to the emergency department. I need you to elaborate on that, because I know there's a talk in the industry right now about alternative sites. But this really, to me, goes after this whole thing about we know there's a fixed cost with emergency rooms, we know there's a fixed cost with LD, we know there's a fixed cost with ambulance services, and this seems to be going the other way, that we're looking at this is pay for performance or is this fee for service. I get it, that's the way the world is set up, but these are fixed costs that are needed in these rural communities. And I don't know why we're not experimenting in that space, but I guess to clarify your point here, was this alternative site or pay for fee for service, or what are you looking into? And last thing I'm going to say is the timeline on this is way too long. As you can see, we just invested $30 million in this only a couple years ago, and seriously, the testifier hit it west. This is not just in Mayo's territory. This is all over the state. We need to fix it. In 5 years, I don't know where this will be. So, sorry. Go ahead. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator, Representative Hewitt. The idea here is that what we keep hearing from EMS providers is that there are runs that they make and they don't receive payment for them if they don't return a patient to an emergency department. So what this will allow us to do is set up the ability to pay for those services when they are rendered. So the ambulance service that currently is receiving nothing for having gone out dealt with an issue, maybe taken care of it at home, maybe referred somebody somewhere else, but didn't need to transport them, that they would be paid for that run. The 5 years that I was referring to is that over the course of that time, I think we will get a really good understanding of which are the providers that this is working for. Is this a longer-term solution to be able to pay for those runs than some of the other maybe shorter-term? Is this just a longer-term way? So it isn't that we would be waiting 5 years to be making those payments. They would be being paid. We're working with the Office of Emergency Medical Services on that. And then part of it would be setting up, and again, working with stakeholders, are there referral patterns that they, or are there ways that they can get information? So if an ambulance goes out to a site and they can see what the problem is, but they know returning to an emergency department isn't really what the needed solution is, that they can then call on what it is and either make a referral or maybe do that treatment right in place, and then again be paid for it. And so the goal behind it was to see if this is a way that would help sustain those rural ambulance services in the long run, but by taking action in the short run.
Thank, Mr. Chair, thank you for your narrative on that. Real quick, and I want to keep the committee going myself here, but Ms. Benson, you served on a committee similar to this in the Senate. I think we're the chair. We worked together at that time. I'm real concerned when we hear the words charity care in a hospital setting. I'm real concerned that constituents of mine and throughout the state think they are paying that bill. They are paying for the charity care on the bottom line because they think it's in some tax bill somewhere that we are supporting charity care by the state. I find I'm on taxes. I've never saw the bottom line where charity care. I mean, we do give grants and stuff like that, but who pays charity care?
Ms. Betson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, charity care is incorporated into the overall hospital's operating budget, and so that means private sector payers who pay more than the cost contribute to the charity care pool. There are donations that contribute to charity care, but there are standards. It's called charity care because there are standards. It isn't somebody walks in and the hospital feels like giving them care. There are standards and criteria that people have to meet, and they submit an application. They do give us some information so that we can meet their needs based on their ability to pay.
So, Mr. Chair,
let me wrap it up, please.
So I've been in active negotiations with hospitals when I did labor contracts, and it always seems like their answer is a little bit more articulate than yours, but it goes back to the workers in the hospital that pay charity care, that they aren't going to get those raises this year. We're going to have to cut benefits, and I think we're going to see a record year for charity care. Across the state, because we know that some things that are happening in a other world here in Washington are going to have effects on this. We're starting to already track people that are not being covered in Commerce. We talked about that this morning. So I have big concerns about this because we have to protect our labor force, and I guess that makes sense to me, but I know that in the ERs I've worked in the past, we never worry about a billfold. We never worry about insurance. Regardless, you show up at that door in an ambulance, you're going to get care. It's the question over where that care is absorbed, and I think we're kind of on the same page here because it's absorbed in operations, but I think it also comes out in our labor force too. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence here.
Yes, members, we have eight people on the list, 10 minutes. Representative Liebling, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just to finish on that thought, I think the bottom line is it's raising costs for other people. So when the federal government kicks people off of Medicaid, those people show up at hospitals and their care is paid for by people of other kinds of insurance. So it raises costs for everyone. I think that's kind of where you were going, Representative Hewitt. But my questions are really, I don't know if I can do this in a minute, Mr. Chair, but I'm really a little confused about this because when I look at a lot of these goals, I mean, of course, Ms. Jones is absolutely right. We have been falling behind on the problem, not really making progress on it in rural health care, and I don't think that's for any lack of work or desire on the part of the Department of Health, but You know, I'm wondering how this all works with existing programs. Kind of this has been alluded to here. You know, you've got some pilot programs you're talking about doing. We've been working on these issues, every single thing in here we've talked about in these committees over the years. I know there are a lot of initiatives going on in the department, probably most legislators, including me. You know, we don't know what the catalog is of those things that are already being done and tried, but we know they're there. Mm-hmm. So I'm really wondering how this dovetails with that. And I'm going to ask all my questions, and then you can answer them, so I don't want to go back and forth with you. But so that's kind of one big question that I have. The second piece of that is, like, what is the net on this? Because the federal government has cut a bunch of stuff. I mean, Dr. Kemp talked about this. We are losing a lot of money in healthcare because of the great big ugly betrayal of a bill, however different people call it. And so they gave us a little money back. So this seems to me, from what I've understood, that this is a lot like, you know, this great, wonderful $50 billion program for all of the states. It's really not a gift. It kind of seems more to me like stabbing somebody and then giving them a Band-Aid to cover the bleeding. That's, you know, my way of understanding this. But I'd really like to understand from your point of view, like, what is the net on this? If you can even figure that out, like, are we gaining something for rural care, or are we net losing for rural care when hospitals may close because of cuts to Medicaid? So that's kind of number two. And then finally, and this is kind of a key thing too, I'm not understanding sort of what the department's authority is to do these things without legislative, okay, without a formal okay, like talking about putting together pilot programs. I mean, isn't that kind of the legislature's prerogative? So it seems to me that the federal government is reaching in and saying, we're cut a bunch of your money, here's some money for you, and you better do it. And where's the legislature in this? I mean, I'm super glad that you're telling us about it today. And I know we can go look for information, but, where's our authority in this? Where's our ability to have our constituents come to us and tell us what they need and then for us to represent that? I'm not criticizing the department on that. I think you're trying to make the best of this stabbing and the Band-Aid. You're administering the Band-Aid. But so those are my questions. I hope you can answer a little bit at least.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, thank you for the questions and a new analogy to use. I might take them out of order and start with the second one about the Band-Aid. I would say that as we were planning for this grant and as we've been moving ahead and implementing, what we have heard from hospitals, from clinics, from communities, from everyone we've talked to is that it is a lot of money and it is not enough to address challenges in rural areas. So for time reasons, we didn't talk about the chart book data that we have that shows some of the really unique, some shared challenges, but some unique ones that exist in rural health around workforce and access and broadband and transportation and finances for rural hospitals. Those problems, we already see the effects of them, and we will see more of them, and Ms. Benson spoke to that really well. This money is really important, and we think it is helpful, and I would say more than a Band-Aid, but it does not offset the challenges that are coming down the pike for rural providers. What we hope is that it positions them and positions us as a state to be more resilient and to be able to weather some of those challenges, whether it's because they've built new partnerships and new relationships with other organizations in the community, with providers in other areas, whether, you know, part of an ECHO network or part of a learning community or whatever that looks like, or whether it's through using technology in a smart way to help them be more financially sustainable. So that is the hope and I think the promise of it, but it does not offset the losses that are coming. And as Ms. Radosevich said, the funding is, hospitals are not allowed to use it to offset lost revenue. So it does leave that gap. In terms of, I'm forgetting how exactly you phrased the question, but it's sort of what are we building on?
How does this mesh with the, sorry,
how does it mesh with existing work? So one of the things we tried to think carefully about in the application period was where are the things that are, I don't like the phrase shovel ready, especially in this context because it can't be used for construction, but where are the places where there is already a foundation because the legislature has created a program, but we can grow it and we can expand it without running into risk of supplanting state funds, which CMS is concerned about. So we heard from MMA about rural residency programs and clinical training opportunities and establishing fellowship programs. We can use these funds to build on a foundation of what the Minnesota legislature has passed, and we can fund new residency slots or new clinical training sites and new fellowships that will be sustainable in the future. But wherever we could, we tried to build on that foundation rather than because of 5 years being both a long time and a really short time to get things done, we didn't want to always have to start from scratch on that. Related to the legislature's authority, there is not new authority that is needed to implement any of what is described here because it falls within the department's general authority to carry out our public health mission. What we want to do, though, is have a really open door with this committee and others and with each of you individually to understand what you're hearing from your constituents and from providers in your communities so we can understand how things are working and where the challenges are and take advantage of those opportunities if we can. We do go through the LEC process as well, so there's that opportunity, but I recognize that's probably not very satisfying. So we want this to be an ongoing conversation about where might state policy changes be needed in the future to sustain any of this.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Folks, we're going to have to take quite a few questions offline because of time constraint. I will take two more. I'm going to let Representative Zalissa Card and then Representative Ryer, and then we got to get to the next bill. So I do apologize, but we do have time is not our friend today. I know this is very important. I even limited my questions. So,
Mr. Chair, Zalissa can I just Card? Make sure that staff is seeing us down here when we raise our hands? I was raising my hand almost the whole time, and so to be missed, I think we need to keep in line with who's raising hands to be acknowledged too. Thank you.
Thank you. Zalissa Card, and then we'll end it with Representative Ryer, Vice Chair Ryer. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. My question is two-part, but my first question is on the administration cost of the $9.7 million. My question is, how many people do we have allocated in the state in MVH that are doing grants right now? I would assume that those grants are have a termination date, and then new grants come up. So I'd like to know how many grants we have right now, because this is to add 26 employees. So then I want to know, is their caseload being reduced? Mm-hmm. Because the grants don't go on forever. So I'd like that question answered and for this committee to know how many employees we have right now to do grants, what their caseload is. And then I'd like you to give us that for that part. And my second question is on the priority number one talks about improving the health outcomes for rural Minnesotans. It talks about kidney disease. My question is, I'm assuming you're seeing non-emergency transportation for greater Minnesota running through priority one, but that piece has to be woven through. There are members on this committee that have served on the EMS task force. Non-emergency transportation is critical in greater Minnesota. And it really goes through all five of these initiatives. If we can't get them to dialysis and we can't get them to the clinic, to the hospital, the only thing left is the ambulance, which is the highest cost. So I encourage you to be looking at real innovative ways to get non-emergency transportation addressed. And I'd love to see where you see that fitting in. Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Zalesnikar, thank you. We can get back to you on the number of employees within the department who have a role in grant making. There are, outside of my division, there are other parts of the department that do grant making, and so I would not have that number. we anticipate with the staff who are being hired, they are being hired for the duration of this grant. The funding goes for that period, and people know when they're applying that they are applying for a grant that ends. And it is open to internal people. So if someone is working on a different grant program within the department, they can apply to move over here. But we will get back to you on the numbers. And I know we have folks taking notes of that. On non-emergency transportation, I don't know that I have a good answer for that. Maybe a follow-up question or a follow-up conversation with you would be helpful on that, just so we understand what you're thinking about.
Okay, Representative Ryer, Vice Chair Ryer, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am going to take my questions offline because I have a boatload of them about implementation, project planning, dental, and turn it over to Representative Keeler instead.
Okay. Representative Keeler, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I guess my question is based on page 11. I don't think you went over this, but I do think it's important for us to see where public input is coming from. Clay County is one of the counties that was not represented, and if you look at the map, Hubbard, Todd, Pope, Grant, Lyon, Pipestone, Rock, if you look at the other maps you provided, those are where we're seeing, like, healthcare reduction. Mm-hmm. So I guess I need to know from you, how did you engage with these counties to make sure that they knew that there was an opportunity for public input? I've just been messaging with my social services director and one of our county commissioners. They knew nothing about this. Mm-hmm. So that's my first question. It is important that if we're going to talk about rural health, we make sure that we know that rural health access and individuals have a voice at the table. The second question I have is, how do we make sure that when these grants come back out, that these counties who were missed in public input also know about the grant opportunity and there's no tie to their lack of input to the opportunity to receive grants? Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Keeler, thank you for the questions, and I'm sorry that it feels like it sounds like the outreach that we did not reach people in the counties that you work with and for. We have done what we can with outreach in terms of our own listservs and our emails and collaborating with partners, whether that be LPHA or our SHAC committee or our Rural Health Committee or whatever it is. But if there were gaps, then I think we need to make sure that we are looping people in on an ongoing basis. We are doing a presentation on this to our State Community Health Services Advisory Committee in just a couple of weeks. We are staying connected with as many different organizations as we can. But if there are gaps in that, we would be happy to talk with you about how we address them and make sure that people have a voice in it.
And I'm going to echo what Representative Keeler is. Clay's not my county, and Hubbard's not my county, but it's Clay is the largest county in the Congressional District 7 population-wise. Mm-hmm. So they service a huge amount of people, and I know they work, of course, across the border with Sanford and so forth. So that is concerning. Also, I have the same concerns that maybe the legislative members didn't get as much input. I realize you had a tight mind, but health matters to everybody. So, Representative Keeler, thank you for sharing that. I know other members on this side also had those concerns. So, we have a lot of work here, like Representative Leaving. I believe we as a body should be more involved with this process and so forth. So, with that said, thank you. We do appreciate it, and let's stay engaged, please. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's fair feedback, and we look forward to more conversations with you here.
Thank you. Okay, members, thank you very much for this discussion. This is very important, I know, to several members on this board, all of us. We have a bill before us. Representative Shoemaker, if you could mosey on up. You got a long distance there, Representative Shoemaker.
Make some shoes. Shoemaker. How about Shoemaker?
And I suspect you'll move your own bill and tell us about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move House File 1925 be referred to the General Register.
Actually, we're going. Oh, never mind. Forgive me. Okay, go ahead. Tell us about your bill.
At least as it stands now.
Yep. You're right. You are correct, Chair. Chair Shoemaker, I should be more formal.
Yes, before amendment here, House File 1925 is the Nurse Licensure Compact. This would allow us to join 43 other states that are also part of this particular compact and align with the seven other compacts that the state of Minnesota entered into over the last couple of years. Just as a side note, we have 29 interstate compacts that we participate in Minnesota, 10 of which are in healthcare. The idea here is to have better care coordination, especially with telehealth and in person. For those of us who represent border communities, it's very important that we have as much coordination in those pieces as we can. There are restrictions and guardrails onto what we have here. Anyone who participates in the nurse licensure compact must pass the same National Council of Licensure examination. And there is a federal criminal background check that is also required here. Essentially, we want nurses to be able to practice to the full extent of their license within this compact here. And I've talked about this bill. I've had this bill a number of times throughout the years. And really thinking today may be the day. But if it's not, the reason that we do this is because of the, especially for me, the border community piece of it and the challenges that come with that. Previously, when this bill has been up, it's been more about the impact on the system, the hospital systems themselves, and coordinating the care piece of it. But over the last couple of years, as in our community, we've developed more nurse training in high school settings and having them come to our old hospital system in Laverne and train. They train in Minnesota while they're in high school, and then they go to Sioux Falls to finish out their licensure training because of the Nurse Licensure Compact. I'm surprised there are not a lot of issues that we talk about in this committee that people recognize generally, but this one is one of those issues that nurses in particular talk to me about and that I hear a lot about, and I see the drain of my own constituents who we were good enough to raise them through high school, but then they go to South Dakota and we don't see them again for that. And so that is why I am bringing this forward once again and hope to make it work this time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. I have an amendment labeled A1. Chair Schumacher, would you like to move your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I will move the A1 amendment. The Nurse Licensure Compact Bill overall is part of, and the reason that we have this in front of us today is it's a recommendation from the Rural Health Transformation Program. The amendment here is also a recommendation from the Rural Health Transformation Program. It allocates 2 hours of each continuing education program to go for physicians, physician assistants, and advanced practice registered nurses to focus on nutrition. And with that, I'd ask for your support.
Okay. Any further questions? Go ahead, Chair Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Question on the A1. Would this nutrition education be something coming from a reputable source? I noticed that the food pyramid's been flipped, and I'm just concerned about some of the guidelines coming out right now with HHS, and I have just a question of if you know the guidelines already for this.
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know exactly what the standards are for the continuing education credits. I just know that this would require that two of them be nutrition-based within that. And so whatever systems are being used now, this would just be options that, or they'd be less electives and more requirements for that.
Yeah, I think that Mr. Chair.
New chair, go sorry. Ahead, chair. No, that's okay. Go ahead,
first
chair.
Day.
Yeah, it is.
I think more education about nutrition is important for all of us, so I don't necessarily disagree with this amendment, but I think anything we're voting on that would go into law, we should know ahead of time what that would be. That would be a prudent step to take, even if we put it on contingently.
Okay. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll go quick, Chair Schumacher. My concern with this is being a a person that has to continuously do CEUs, and having the people that sit at this table decide which CEUs they should do, it's more of government overreach again. I think the medical practice boards and the nursing board could very much tell what's actively going on in the community right now and what they have to look at. We all have had these discussions with people that come in our office about, oh, the EMTs have to learn this, the nurses have to use this. When are we going to draw a line to this? This is really, I think this is cantankerous. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Schumacher.
Chair Schumacher.
Oh, no.
Did you have any questions? Okay. Then we have Representative Ryer, Vice Chair Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Schumacher. My question is, this is really broad. Does this apply to all physicians, PAs, nurses, APRNs, rather, regardless of the nature of their practice?
Representative, Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ryer. That is my understanding, yes.
Any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm picturing someone going in for surgery, say, and as the surgeon is saying, we're going to do thus and such, they need to have, this is a good use of their ongoing training. How does that fit with their actual practice?
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. That is a fair question. I don't have a good answer for you on that and how that directly applies, not being a physician myself or having to make determinations on what I'm going to do continuing education on for that. Okay. So that's the best I can give you.
Ms. Chair Liebling, you're on the list.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question kind of went the same direction. I'm just really puzzled, like a forensic pathologist would have to get 2 hours of nutrition. Or my daughter-in-law, who is a PA who does derm, you know, if you're going to say that, because 2 hours of one thing displaces 2 hours of something else that may be actually relevant to them. So I don't understand why we're dealing with this. And maybe my question for you, Chair Schumacher, is like, you mentioned that this was part of the rural health transformation. Could you explain a little bit, like, why is this being brought? I really don't understand what the purpose is. This really runs contrary to the way we've done this. We don't sit here at the table and decide what kind of education different practitioners should have.
Mr. Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. Yes, so when I was talking about this, was a recommendation as part of the Rural Health Transformation Program, future monies that get allocated to the state are going to be based on those recommendations that they have, this being one of those programs. The other amendment that we talk about, another one of those programs. And so the thought is here, by passing these, we would be eligible for more funds from that program in the future. That's where it's coming from.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I guess I just would say then that sounds to me like we're just letting the Trump administration decide for us what we should do here with our practitioners in the state, or hope do things that we think they might like. Maybe RFK Jr. might like this, and then we'll hope that that'll make them look more favorably on us in the future. I don't know if I don't want to put that in your mouth, Representative Schumacher, but, you know, that's kind of what it seems like to me, and I certainly would not support this.
Okay. Representative Bonner. And then we have Representative Carroll, and then we'll take a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I guess my question is somewhat similar in that, you know, I'm trying to understand what we're trying to solve with this and what we're trying to do here. I mean, should ortho surgeons and residents be training on nutrition? Should it be, should advanced practice nurses who have considerable amounts of continuing education that they do on a regular basis. It's why we hold Minnesota nurses up to the highest possible standard in the entire country. It's because they have these continuing education that they must do that relates to the specifics of their job and as they do it each and every day. They have very specific specialties. My mom was a cardiac critical care unit nurse. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know that 2 hours of training on nutrition
is at the top of her list. But knowing how to make sure that she can handle cardiac arrhythmias might be, right? If there's new technology or techniques to look at that. I really struggle with that. And moreover, if the whole point of this is so that we can get access to a pot of money from the federal government for doing something that doesn't make any sense, does this not fit exactly into the pot of waste, fraud, and abuse? Isn't this wasteful? I mean, why would we do this? It really literally makes zero sense and is completely wasteful to be asking practitioners who have no relation to nutrition to be taking a class on nutrition. It sounds like wasting money just to waste money. And I don't know about you, but as a taxpayer, I don't really feel like doing that. That would be my, so it, maybe you have more that you can shed light, you can shed on why we're doing this and what we're solving by doing it.
Mr. Chair Schumacher, do you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to reiterate the same points that we had before, we have access to a pot of money and this helps us get more with that, and that's why I brought the amendment forward today.
Okay, and then finally on this amendment, Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. A lot of my concerns have been addressed by these previous questions, but let me just ask, how much is the pot of money we're talking about?
I do not know that answer. I'm sorry. I thought you were looking at me.
I was looking at you.
Okay, good.
Addressed the question you to.
I know I mistook your Mr. Chair Schumacher. I'm going punt to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Carroll. That amount is undetermined at this point. The federal government, is my understanding, needs to know and see more of what the states are doing with the recommendations that were made in that program before they can determine a full allotment.
Thank you. It sounds like this is ready for prime time, and I won't support it.
Okay. With that said, hearing no more discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
I pretty much think this is down partisan line, so the motion fails. So I'm due to a tie. Okay. What we're going to do is be with time limit, we're going to skip to Amendment A. If you are not objected, Amendment 3, would you be
able to? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the A3 amendment. This is just getting to the base bill for the compact, updating the language. Of course, this bill was introduced last year with high hopes that it would be in the 2025 season. This just changes it to the 2026 season for that.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. Hearing none. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Okay. The motion prevails. We're going to jump into our testifiers.
Mr. Chair, a point.
Yep, go ahead, Representative Hewitt.
A2, are we going, is this being withdrawn, or what are we doing with this one? Because you weren't clear on what you're doing with it.
Mr. Chair Schumacher, would you?
We can do it quick. I think the conversation
okay.
Very similar to the.
Yep. Well, if we can do it quick, I want to get to the testifiers. So let's do that. Representative Schumacher moves an amendment labeled A2. Does everybody have a copy of that amendment? Can you tell us about that amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the same reasons that the A1 amendment was offered, there was also a recommendation in the Rural Health Transformation Program that would reinstate the presidential fitness test. This would compel schools to participate and offer parents an opportunity to opt out of it. If this were to be adopted, then we would change the initial motion to re-refer this to the Education Policy Committee for further consideration.
Okay, further discussion. Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed?
No.
I think it fails. Motion fails. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
One other thing. At the end of the bill, there is an appropriation. So instead of the general register, I would think it would have to go two ways or state gov if it does pass today.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, along the same line, I think that these compact bills also went to judiciary before because they have legal implications. So I think that if the bill leaves this committee, which I think is a big if, it would have to go also to judiciary, I believe,
okay,
at some point. So if, you know, I don't know what the next stop would be.
Okay. Okay, very good. Well, point well taken. Today we have testifiers. Hearing from six testifiers on House File 1925. First one is Ms. April Gunho. What's that? She's on Zoom. Okay. Are we? You got it. But you got it. I don't know what to use. While we're working on that, we're going to go to the second one. John Porter with the Minnesota Organization of Leaders in Nursing. We do have to, because of time, keep your testimony down to a minute and a half, please.
Minute and a half?
Thank you.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair, members. My name is John Porter. I am a registered nurse, a nurse leader here in the state of Minnesota, and also a member of the Minnesota Organization of Leaders in Nursing. I'm here to ask for your support in Minnesota joining the Nurse Licensure Compact. I bring kind of a unique perspective. I was a nurse in Texas and Oklahoma for a number of years before I came up here. I think Minnesota does healthcare exceptionally well. Now, from a nurse leadership perspective, workforce flexibility is not a luxury. It's essential to maintaining safe, uninterrupted patient care. Healthcare systems across the state invest significant time and resources in workforce planning. The Nurse Compact will allow us to provide a modern, regulated mechanism to responsibly bridge gaps. What happens is, despite all of our planning, lots of times multiple factors will happen, multiple variables will occur, such as unexpected absences, leave of absences, vacancies, seasonal gaps, such as a flu shortage, that creates these gaps. The Nurse Compact allows us to bridge these gaps in a safe and responsible manner. And my real point, when I'm really here, is it's not just a short-term bridge. I think that the Nurse Compact Act will allow us to act as a long-term recruitment strategy. I think that when we bring nurses from other states here, they're going to experience the culture, the workforce that's here. This is an amazing place to be, to work, to live, to raise a family. I think they come here, they see how good it is. I think they're going to stay. So I would ask very much for your support to help us support our workforce short and long term.
Thank you. Are we ready with Zoom? Okay, next we have Ms. Gayton, RN, and then on deck is Ms. Arnold, RN. And thank you, Mr. Porter. Please state your name and...
My name's Tani Gaitan. I'm a nurse at Alina Health in Owatonna. I was born and raised in Minnesota. I graduated in 28 with my nursing license here. I travel nurse for 4 years throughout Alaska, Iowa, and Wisconsin. I get my license through endorsement. Every state has different requirements for what lets them be a nurse. Every state has different practice laws. So because of that, South Dakota, Montana, Wisconsin, Colorado, none of these states require continuing education for their nurses to renew their license. In the compact, nurses only need to renew their license in the original state that they were licensed, and they're allowed to work in other states. For example, Minnesota nurses would have a huge leg up. We are much greater qualified than other states. Other states, such as states from South Dakota, as you so mentioned, Representative Schumacher, they don't need to continue their education. They don't require any credits. These nurses have a much greater authority of care as well. When I share patient and staffing stories from my travel days to nurses in Minnesota, they consider them unfathomable simply because these types of situations don't occur in Minnesota. Yet, they can quickly and repeatedly if we weaken our standards by passing the compact. I've had nursing supervisors try to tell me to tuck patients in because a seizure patient from the ER when we're already over safe ratios and say the next staff can deal with it. In Iowa, I had up to 8 patients a day on day shift on a post-cardiac floor. 4-1 is the highest it should ever be in Minnesota. I have witnessed firsthand so many safety violations. The last thing I will say, in interest of time, is that simply saying having a greater pool of nurses available directly equal better patient ratios is irresponsible and narrow-minded. We don't receive the same experiences and we don't have the same standards as other states. I think it's important for our patients to remain safe by holding our standards and keeping the compact out. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Arnold, and then after that on deck is Ms. Mitz. So go ahead.
Ms. Good afternoon, Arnold. Chair Backer and committee members. My name is Laura Arnold, and I am a Minnesota-trained registered nurse. I've been in Minnesota my entire career. As you all know, Nurse Compact allows nurses to obtain the primary state their license in primary state of residence, and then practice in other compact states. As the previous testifier said, that does not mean all these nurses are created equal. Their competency can be vastly different. For example, in Minnesota, we are required to do continuing education to stay on top of the latest trends, our changing trends, and latest information in patient care. As my previous testifier said, other states do not require that. If nurses are brought in from other states, the populations that face significant risks of negative impacts are those seeking reproductive care, including abortion care and gender-affirming care. The right to receive these cares were deemed so vital that Minnesota saw fit to legislate these protections for these patients and providers right into our constitutional law. Whereas many compact states explicitly ban gender-affirming care, abortion, and other reproductive care. We know how the employers operate. We know that an out-of-state nurse coming to Minnesota to provide care will face significant training barriers in getting up to speed with Minnesota laws. This could even lead a nurse to inadvertently put their license at risk. I have been a nurse at Children's Minnesota for over 18 years and currently work in the inpatient mental health unit. Throughout my career, I have seen the impact of having access to gender-affirming care has had on the LGBTQ+ population. Many vulnerable patients look to Minnesota for access to reproductive health, abortion, and gender-affirming care. The LGBTQ+ community is particularly vulnerable to decreased access to health care. Finally, I will say it is imperative we are able to advocate and have expert care to save lives, because if you do not know how to care for these people properly, their mental health is at extreme risk. I urge you to oppose House File 1925. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can you please remind the committee about outbursts, especially during testifiers? Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Andrea Kemps?
Kemets,
thank you. And then after that, we have Ms. Bringley. New Bringley will be on after you. Go ahead, please. Minute and a half, please.
Hi there. Good afternoon, Chair Becker and Co-Chair Bierman and all the committee members. My name is Andrea Kemets, and I'm a proud registered nurse and member of the Minnesota Nurses Association, the union representing 80% of nurses that actively work at the bedside in hospitals across our state. Hospital administrators and lobbyists talk extensively about the crisis in the nursing workforce in our state, but they do not actually address the root of the problem, which is that they, the employers, have created work environments that are unsafe for workers and patients and simply unsustainable. These same administrators have also done nothing of substance to address rampant retention issues. In fact, some of the big systems will openly talk about their 25% annual turnover rate, as if nurses are dispensable and that it's just a cost of doing business. Proponents of this bill claim it's a solution, that it will make it easier to bring more nurses into the state. But from data from compact states, does not support this claim. Hospitals and nursing homes in compact states are experiencing the same sorts of workforce issues we are here in Minnesota. This bill is a false solution and a smokescreen to shield the employers from fixing the things that are very much within their control right now. Chronic understaffing puts patients and nurses at risk, and persistent workplace violence that hospital administrators continue to ignore. These are the reasons that nurses continuously cite as to why they are leaving their jobs, If hospital CEOs really want to address the nursing workforce issues in our state, they will start listening to nurses and start addressing the issues we have been saying out loud for years as to why our colleagues keep leaving the bedside. Please support nurses, patients, and labor by opposing HF 1925. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you, ma'am. Okay, and then we have Ms. New Bringley, and then after that we have Ms. April Gunhold. Go ahead, please. Minute and a half. Thank you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Ann New Brindley, and I represent the Minnesota Business Partnership. The Minnesota Business Partnership strongly supports Minnesota joining the Nurse Licensure Compact. As we all know, Minnesota is a leader in healthcare delivery. Nurses are central to our healthcare system and valued, as is evidenced by the fact that nurses in Minnesota are among the highest paid in the country. While at the same time, Minnesota remains outside of the compact while all of our neighboring states participate, this puts our providers at a disadvantage and limits their ability to respond quickly to staffing needs. The Nurse Licensure Compact, which is functioning in the majority of states at this point, is a proven, well-established framework that allows nurses to practice in multiple states under a single multi-state license while fully preserving Minnesota's authority over scope of practice and discipline. It improves workforce mobility, supports telehealth, and expands access to care without compromising patient safety. I would add, workforce flexibility is especially critical right now as Minnesota implements its new paid family medical leave program. While the Minnesota Business Partnership recognizes the importance of paid leave to employees and families, the new structure is already resulting in longer and more frequent workforce absences that are exacerbated in the healthcare sector. Healthcare employers face a unique challenge. They are responsible both for providing essential care to all Minnesotans and for employing the nurses who are the caregivers that families will turn to as needs arise. From a business and workforce perspective, joining the Nurse Licensure Compact is a low-cost, high-impact policy change that will make it easier to recruit nurses from other compact states and maintain continuity of care during these staffing disruptions. For these reasons, the Minnesota Business Partnership urges policymakers to support Minnesota's entry into the Nurse Licensure Compact to strengthen our healthcare workforce, improve access to care, and ensure that Minnesota remains a leader in healthcare delivery. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And then we're going to go to Zoom. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Can you hear me okay?
We hear you loud and clear. Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't know if you heard, you got a minute and a half, please.
Yes, absolutely, Mr. Chair. My name is April Grunov, and I have been a registered nurse for over 20 years, and I currently serve as the Chief Nursing Officer at Riverview Health in Crookston, Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to join virtually today in a snowstorm that we're experiencing up here in support of Minnesota joining the Nurse Licensure Compact. For the past 17 years, I have met directly with our newly hired nurses during their onboarding, first as an employee health nurse and now as a nurse leader. The consistent theme and frustration that I have heard from many of the nurses is the burdensome process of obtaining a Minnesota license for nurses that are already licensed in a compact state. The current process prevents nurses from starting work promptly, delaying their earnings, and limits timely access to care for our communities. My message has been the same, an apology for their experience, an offer of support in any way that I can, and a strong sense of optimism and advocacy that Minnesota advances this legislation for the profession of nursing. I speak on behalf of all of those nurses with hope that their future colleagues have a more seamless experience. Now is that time. Additionally, as Chair Schumacher mentioned, because Minnesota is not a licensure compact state, our hospital, which is located just 25 miles from the North Dakota border, currently covers the cost for our nurses to maintain dual licensure so we can provide telehealth and care coordination to patients residing in North Dakota. This creates unnecessary financial and administrative burden. From a finance and policy perspective, the compact reduces administrative burden for both the state and employers improves workforce mobility, and enhances Minnesota's competitiveness in attracting nurses who are increasingly expecting multi-state practice flexibility. I respectfully urge the committee to advance this legislation and position Minnesota for a stronger, more resilient healthcare workforce. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, members. Seeing, is there any questions? Just to give you outline, we will go to vote at the 44 mark, so 244. It looks like Representative Dole, did you have a question? And then I have Representative Gilman, and I think that will be our only two members that can do questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Schumacher. I actually have a question if Andrea Kmetz can come back up. But while she's coming up, Representative Schumacher, can you look at lines 4.22 to 4.28? There was some testimony in the bill that was talking about how our state board, our state licensure would be circumvented. And it appears to me that you've addressed that in this bill, line 4.22 to 4.28. Can you just speak to that quickly before I ask Ms. Kmetz a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Nadeau. The thing with compacts, this isn't my language. This is the compact language for that. And so while I'd like to take credit for something that seemed to be insightful for this, I cannot. This is the language that is required to become part of the compact word for word and on here. But it is, as you read it, in there. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Mr. Chair, can I ask Annie to comment on this?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but Ms. Clark Best shouldn't comment on that.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe this paragraph is talking about a nurse having to practice. This talks about the nurse's practice. Mm-hmm. This doesn't necessarily talk about the nurse's requirements for licensure. So it says the nurse has to comply with the state practice laws in the state where the client is located, where the patient is, not where the nurse received his or her initial license.
Representative Dole.
So just one follow-up then. So let's just say that Minnesota requires an extra 3 years to become a licensed nurse. If an out-of-state license doesn't have that three-year requirement, would they be able to practice in Minnesota with this paragraph?
My understanding is yes, they
okay.
would be able to. Because
okay.
this paragraph relates to the care they can provide,
okay.
not the qualifications for licensure.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kmetz, you mentioned in your testimony that having a compact would not help solve the problem. And in Minnesota, we do have a problem. We have a problem across the board. I recognize that 80% of the nurses are MNA nurses in our major hospitals, but they are a small portion of the overall nurses in the state. We have 150,000 nurses. How can this not help by opening up that opportunity like the administrator or the nurse at Ridgeview? How could this not help?
Go ahead.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. How would this not help? So when I look at a compact, I've been a registered nurse for a long time. I currently work at the nursing as a nursing practice and education specialist at Minnesota Nurses Association. We are bound by our Nurse Practice Act to provide the best care to our patients that we are possibly able to do. And you are absolutely correct that there is a problem, right? There's a problem with nurses are not being listened to, that they're being held to standards that are unobtainable, that you can't take on 8 patients on a day shift and be able to take care of them the way that those patients deserve to be taken care of. So when you're talking about how nurses are replaceable by nurses from another state that do not have the same standards of care, do not go to the same education, do not have to sustain the same amount of educational background, when you bring them into, they're not going to know the difference. I also want to talk about the fact that when it comes down to the working conditions that nurses currently have, CEOs, CNOs, they put these nursing practice conditions in place. There's policies and procedures that they have to follow. We don't have the ability to say, no, we're not taking care of that patient, because that's not what we do. We take care of our patients. Any patient that's in front of us, we're going to take care of. But people are getting burnt out because we have a true passion for taking care of these patients, and we want the best for them. We want to do everything to the best of our power, but we're spread thin. We don't have the resources that we need. We don't have the support of the hospital systems. I left the bedside because I wanted to make a difference and help promote nursing practice and be able to stand up for our patients and be able to truly help them to the best of our abilities.
Okay, I need you to wrap up. Okay. Final comment.
Thank you. And I don't know if you answered my question, and I think that's why I brought up the practice question earlier, is that, you know, any nurse that comes from another state has to match the practice requirements that we have in the state. And so I think that's my point, is that having more opportunity to have more nurses practice under the requirements that we have in this state. My question was, and I don't want you to answer it, we're out of time, and I will follow up with you after this, thank you, is that I just don't understand why not opening that up would for more practicing nurses under our practice requirements that are in this statute, how that couldn't help our healthcare system. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to go to a vote.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I'd like to ask for a roll call.
Okay, roll call has been called. So,
Mr. Chair, can you reiterate, please, what the path of this is before we
take
the vote?
Yes, I was going to do that, Representative Barnes. I was going to give Schumacher a final word. Representative Schumacher, any final words to this bill?
No, Mr. Chair, just to say that I believe Representative Liebling is right on the he said there was that little gnawing voice in the back of my head that they had to go somewhere else. So I would hope that the motion would be to send it as amended to the Judiciary Committee.
Yes, we're landing the airplane on that. So the House File 1925 as amended would be recommended and referred to the Judicial Committee. So with that said, we're going to take a roll call.
Chair Becker?
Aye.
Chair Bierman?
No.
Vice Chair Nadeau?
Aye.
Vice Chair Rarer?
No.
Representative Bonner?
No.
Representative Carroll?
No.
Representative DeBell?
Aye.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Franson?
Yes.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Keeler?
No.
Representative Knutson?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
No.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Mahmoud?
No.
Representative Perryman?
Yes.
Representative Purcell?
Purcell, no.
Representative Rapinski?
Aye.
Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, aye.
Representative Van Binsberg?
Aye.
Representative Zelenskar?
Zelenskar, aye.
Okay, motion, the vote is 11-11 due to a tie. The motion does not prevail. Okay, folks, thank you for our first committee meeting. Our next meeting will be Monday at the same location, same time, under the direction of co-chair Bierman. With that, seeing no further business, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members.